Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today we open our show with details on the guilty plea entered by Congressman Duncan Hunter's wife, Margaret, on federal corruption charges and what that could mean for the East County Republican Congressman's future. Next up, we'll have details about an upcoming vote by grocery workers that could lead to a strike against major grocery chains. On our Capitol Report, President Donald Trump's statement that he would accept information from a foreign government on opponents in the 2020 election has drawn sharp criticism even from top Republicans in the Senate, and an admonishment from the head of the Federal Elections Commission warning that such action is illegal. In local news, hear about record high temperatures set this last week and about priorities to help people in need in the county's budget. We'll also have news about expanding health care for middle and low-income Californians in the proposed state budget. Hear about a family seeking witnesses to a bicycle accident in Guate and a vacancy on the El Cajon Planning Commission. Also hear how the county is gearing up for what could be a severe fire season. Then on Destination East County, we'll have events from Father's Day festivities to 4th of July celebrations. There's a health alert on frozen blackberries, and we'll have details. Then on Sounds of History, as East County's own Impossible Railway gears up to celebrate its centennial, we'll be re-airing our interview with Dick Panic, brakeman at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. Plus, hear about the 100 deadly days of summer and tips for teenagers on how to stay safe when driving after an engaged young couple lost their lives on Highway 94 in Hamul. So stay tuned for the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Congressman Duncan Hunter's wife, Margaret, has pleaded guilty to conspiring with her husband to use campaign funds for a family vacation to Italy charged on the campaign's credit card. She also attested to $200,000 in fraudulent spending involving at least 30 different illegal transactions. Her 22-page plea agreement implicates Congressman Hunter in many other criminal offenses. Margaret Hunter could face up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine, but most likely will serve a shorter sentence, possibly with no time behind bars, for helping the prosecution. Mrs. Hunter, a mother of three children, is scheduled to be sentenced on September 16th, 6 days after Congressman Hunter's corruption trial is slated to begin. Her attorney, Thomas McNamara, read a statement to reporters in which Margaret Hunter says she has accepted full responsibility for her conduct and is deeply remorseful. Congressman Hunter sent a statement via email to the Times of San Diego in which he called for his wife to be left alone by the press. He calls the case politically motivated, noting that local U.S. attorneys attended fundraisers for Hillary Clinton. Hunter faces 60 counts of stealing money from his campaign along with his wife and falsifying campaign finance reports to cover their crimes. Mrs. Hunter's plea deal admits that she and her husband agreed to knowingly and willfully convert campaign funds to personal use at a time when the Hunters spent substantially more than they earned. The Hunters were in debt with an overdrawn bank account and credit cards maxed out with late fees. They owed money to their children's school, the family dentist, and other creditors. U.S. Attorney Robert Brewer Jr., a Trump nominee, issued a press release stating that both Hunters were aware that each was spending campaign funds on personal expenses, sometimes without informing the other. The illegal actions started in 2009 and continued through 2016, that's 7 years, with campaign funds spent on vacations to Hawaii, Europe, and Idaho, school tuition, dental work, golf, tequila, video games for their children, jewelry, and flying a pet rabbit named Egbert twice on family trips. They falsely described such actions as campaign travel and other campaign purposes, according to federal prosecutors. Last year, Hunter blamed his wife, telling media, "I didn't do it," and adding that Margaret was in charge of the campaign's finances. She had a campaign credit card, but she was not the treasurer. In fact, her plea deal reveals that the treasurer repeatedly warned both Hunters that their actions were illegal, and yet they continued the lavish personal spending with campaign donors' money. Margaret Hunter's guilty plea will not absolve her husband of all guilt. In addition to actions taken jointly with his wife, Hunter is also accused of spending campaign funds on hotel trysts with mistresses, including a campaign staffer. Hunter won a Republican primary last June before the indictments were issued against him, and then narrowly beat Democratic rival Amar Campanjar in November after the indictments were issued. If he's found guilty and sent to prison, his fate is uncertain. There is no constitutional requirement for him to lose his seat, even if he's behind bars and can't vote, although it's likely that the Democratic-controlled House would vote to eject him. That could result in a special election, depending on the timing. Three Republicans have announced plans to run for Hunter's 50th congressional district seat, which includes much of East County as well as San Diego. They are El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells, retired Navy SEAL Larry Wilski, and Temecula Councilman Matt Rahm. Democrat Amar Campanjar, who came within a few percentage points of winning in the heavily red district in 2018, is also campaigning again for the 2020 election. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A strike by grocery workers at major supermarket chains in Southern California could begin as early as June 25th, after a June 24th vote scheduled by seven Southern California union locals that represent employees at Albertsons, Ralph's, and Vons. Times of San Diego reports that according to Todd Walters, president of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 135, a three-year-old contract expired in March, though some provisions are still in force and talks have broken down. On Facebook, the local accuses the company of slashing wages for cashiers, giving wage hikes for top clerks of just 20 cents that don't keep pace with the minimum wage increase and puts workers' health care plan at risk of bankruptcy. Workers say they're looking for a fair deal. Walters also criticized companies for a disparity between how much people hired before and after the last strike are receiving. John Votova from Kroger, which owns Ralph's, says the company is negotiating in good faith for a fair and balanced contract. Representatives from the other grocery chains did not respond to a request for Times of San Diego, a news partner of ours. Meanwhile, a bill that would let striking workers collect unemployment insurance benefits is wending its way through the California State House. AB 1066 by San Diego Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher was approved by the Assembly and sent to the State Senate in May, where it has been referred to committee. If approved and signed in its present form, workers could get jobless benefits after 4 weeks on strike. The California Chamber of Commerce calls the bill a job killer, that it would incentivize strikes and expose employers to a significant cost increase during a time in which they are already struggling with the financial impact of labor negotiations and a strike. But Vons worker Donna Villa Gomez calls striking the last resort, adding that employers keep too many workers in fear because they are one paycheck away from missing the rent or a car payment. When workers are eligible for unemployment insurance, she says, they can stand up for fair treatment and workplace conditions knowing that families won't become homeless. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. President Donald Trump has sent shockwaves through the nation's capital after he told ABC that if a foreign government offered him dirt on a political opponent in the 2020 election, quote, "I think I'd want to hear it," adding, "I think I'd take it." But a top federal elections regulator, several Republican senators, and Democratic presidential candidates have all issued statements sharply critical of the president's remarks and made clear that accepting any such help from a foreign power is a crime. Trump later added, "If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go, maybe, to the FBI." Trump also said he believes FBI Director Christopher Wray was wrong when he testified to Congress that campaign workers should always report offers of help from foreign entities to the FBI. But Federal Election Commission Chair Ellen Weintraub immediately issued this statement on illegal contributions from foreign governments. She says, "Let me make something 100% clear to the American public and anyone running for public office. It is illegal for any person to solicit, accept, or receive anything of value from a foreign national in connection with a U.S. election." She adds that this is not a novel concept. Electoral intervention from foreign governments has been considered unacceptable since the beginning of our nation, the FEC chair says. Our founding fathers sounded the alarm about foreign interference, intrigue, and influence. They knew that when foreign governments seek to influence American politics, it is always to advance their own interests, not America's. And, she states pointedly, anyone who solicits or accepts foreign assistance risks being on the wrong end of a federal investigation, adding that any such offer to a campaign should always be reported to the FBI. Now, Trump's remarks came shortly after his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, said he wasn't sure if he would report an offer of foreign help to the FBI. But even many top Republicans and Trump allies admit that such actions do violate federal law. Senator Lindsey Graham, a staunch Trump supporter, says he told the president, "The law is pretty clear. You can't take anything of value from a foreign government," Politico reports. Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney, a former presidential nominee, stated bluntly, "Accepting the work product of a foreign government or the effort of a foreign government to try and influence an election of one candidate or another, it simply strikes at the heart of our democracy. It's wrong." Colorado Senator Cory Gardner, another Republican, made clear that any foreign information offered on a candidate's opponent should be turned over to the FBI, pure and simple. And Senator Susan Collins of Maine, also a Republican, similarly states that the appropriate response if the president or any other presidential candidate is approached by a hostile government is to call the FBI. Only Senate Leader Mitch McConnell, who has himself taken massive contributions from Russians, took a different view, blaming Democrats, whom he says are trying to keep the 2016 election alive and the investigation alive when the American people have heard enough. Now, during his 2016 campaign, Trump infamously quipped, "Russia, are you listening?" and suggested that Russia should hack Hillary Clinton's emails. And in fact, they did. A Russian lawyer later met with top Trump campaign aides and the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., promising to dish up damaging information on Clinton. Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor, stated in his report after analyzing that meeting that a foreign entity providing free opposition research to a campaign could exert a greater effect on an election and a greater tendency to ingratiate the donor to the candidate. A president ingratiated to a foreign country, in other words. Larry Noble, former general counsel for the FEC, has made clear, "A contribution is anything of value. Opposition research is clearly something of value. If a campaign tells a foreign government it would accept opposition research they've gathered, it is soliciting a foreign contribution, which is illegal. If the campaign accepts the opposition research, it is accepting a prohibited foreign contribution." Numerous Democratic presidential contenders also blasted Trump's statement. Biden posted on Twitter, "President Trump is once again welcoming foreign interference in our election. This isn't about politics. It is a threat to our national security. An American president should not seek their aid and abet those who seek to undermine democracy." California Senator Kamala Harris tweeted, "China is listening. Russia is listening. North Korea is listening. Let's speak the truth. This president is a national security threat." Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said on CNN, "We have a president that neither understands the Constitution of the United States or respects the Constitution." Sanders described Trump as somebody who does not believe in the separation of powers and somebody who thinks he's above the law.
It took cease and desist letters sent by two attorneys to the Cajon Valley Union School District for our media outlet, East County Magazine, to obtain recordings of public meetings previously denied, along with assurances that our reporters will not be threatened for recording those meetings ourselves. But other important records requests remain pending from the timeframes mandated by state law. More than 5 months after our initial Public Records Act request for tapes of public meetings, the Cajon Valley Union School District has turned over all but one recording from last December through March 2019. Miraculously, those include a December 11th recording that the district previously informed us had been destroyed. One audio file for March 12, 2019 was not available due to a technical difficulty, the district claims in a letter sent to Terry Frank, attorney for Californians Aware, or CalAware. The records were provided to Frank after the attorney notified the district that its refusal to provide copies of recordings to our reporter, Paul Cruz, and to board member Jill Bartow violated the Ralph M. Brown Act, California's Public Records Act. The district's purported destruction of the December recording after 30 days, despite a records request made just one day after the meeting, as claimed by Executive Assistant Naomi Rodriguez, was also illegal, Frank informed the district. Now, the district is refusing to provide CDs for any meetings unless a request is made within 30 days of a meeting, backtracking off their vote in late March to retain recordings for a year. In the past, people who tried to set appointments to go listen to recordings were stonewalled, and anyone from out of town, such as our attorney, would not be able to hear audios requested after 30 days. This is anything but transparent government and begs the question, why is the Cajon Valley Union School District making it so hard to access what happens at their public meetings? So what was on the destroyed December audio tape since found? Among other things, a report by a public safety consultant with recommendations for correcting security flaws to protect student safety in the event of a school shooter, recommendations that thus far the district has failed to implement. There were also harsh criticisms made by parent Mark Roback over 8 schools failing to meet state academic standards. Due to the district's obstruction, East County Magazine has been taping meetings since March and posting our own recordings on our news site. The district didn't like that, so at 3 consecutive meetings, it attempted to interfere with our ability to record clear audio. Attorney Corey Briggs sent a letter in mid-May to the district advising that it was also in violation of the Brown Act for refusing to allow audio and video recordings unless our reporters headed to the back of the room, and for threatening to arrest reporter Paul Cruz if he did not comply. The district denies these actions, but multiple witnesses confirm the district did ask reporters, including ECM editor Miriam Raftery and reporter Paul Cruz, to move to the back or place recording equipment under a noisy air conditioner. One such exchange was captured on video. In each case, our reporters refused to move and remained in the front row, risking arrest to protect your right to know what the school board is doing. But fortunately, police did not arrive. One video blogger for a local blog site did move to the back, obtaining poorer quality audio and video as a result, according to posts left by viewers. Briggs' letter also warned the district that individual board members can be charged with misdemeanor crimes if they are present at a meeting at which they are aware of efforts to interfere with the public's right to information to which the public is entitled. This includes the right to record meetings, particularly in light of the board's past efforts to withhold recordings in violation of state law. Our recording device, the size of a cell phone, does not obstruct any views or impede traffic flow in the boardroom. Board President Tamara Otero sent Briggs a letter in response, which, while not admitting guilt, did agree to cease and desist from these allegations. And on June 11th, the board voted to approve the cease and desist order in order to avoid unnecessary litigation. However, the district has still not complied with many other Public Records Act requests, including our May 8th request for a copy of Superintendent David Miyashiro's contract, which we have still not received as of our show deadline. Timeliness is important, given that his contract came up for renewal on June 11th. Frank, Calaware's lawyer, has advised us that it is not legal to routinely request delays for items that should be readily available, such as a contract, though extra time can be requested for more complex requests that require an extensive search, such as when older documents are put into a storage facility. East County Magazine has covered dozens of local boards and commissions since our inception in 2009, and this is the only district that has regularly failed to comply promptly to numerous records requests, and that has sought to obstruct or delay release of items commonly made easily accessible to the press and public through other local public agencies. In an era where several other local superintendents and education district leaders have been indicted or convicted on criminal corruption charges, Cajon Valley's continued obstruction efforts raise a key question. Why are they trying so hard to hide public records instead of providing the children in their school district with role models of transparency and open government? Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is John Fisteer with a weather report from San Diego's East County. The heat wave, which prompted an excessive heat warning on Tuesday, brought record-breaking temperatures across East County. So how hot was it? In Borrego Springs, a high of 115 degrees broke an all-time record set 34 years ago for the date June 11th. Campo hit 102 degrees, breaking a 39-year-old record. The high temperatures and low humidity have also elevated fire danger. with several small brush fires quelled by firefighters. Next up, temperatures are expected to cool off significantly, staying cooler through Tuesday across most of the county, though triple-digit heat will continue in the desert areas.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
The county's most vulnerable residents are the focus of a new recommended budget formally presented to the County Board of Supervisors on June 10th. The $6.2 billion budget for fiscal year 2019-2020 invests $112 million in new spending for residents struggling to get by in our region. Although the total budget is actually 1% lower than last year due to one-time capital improvement projects in the last fiscal year, spending on programs is proposed to actually increase by $322 million. That increase will fund services for people with mental health or substance use disorders and those experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness. The budget also aims to help address the lack of affordable housing and help children and families in the foster care system. The county is adding 338 new staff positions, with 270 of those in the Health and Human Services Agency. The budget includes hiring more social workers, mental health clinicians, housing and aging specialists. This continues a trend over the last 2 years when discretionary spending on health and human services doubled. There's also extra money to add more psychiatric beds and fund 70 psychiatric response teams. Over $17 million is allocated for the No Place Like Home program, which helps people access mental health services if they're homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. The budget doubles the Housing Trust Fund to $50 million for creating affordable housing for homeless families, veterans, older adults with low incomes, people with special needs, and, again, those at risk of being homeless. Over 700 affordable housing units will be built on excess county property. Child Welfare Services will have 65 new positions, including staff to investigate child abuse and social workers trained to reduce family violence. Public Health Services will add 18 new positions to identify trends and monitor infectious diseases such as measles. Plus, the budget boosts funding related to Alzheimer's disease. Two new achievement centers aim to prevent young people from returning to the juvenile justice system. Funds are also slated to maintain Safe Destination Nights, a recreational program keeping thousands of teenagers off the streets during the evening hours. Continued funds for the Fresh Start program will help adults with criminal records overcome barriers to success as well. The county is also exploring sustainable energy options, such as community choice, and will continue implementing its climate action plan to reduce greenhouse gases. That includes planting 3,500 trees on our public lands and adding 500 more acres of open space to the 41,000 acres already preserved in San Diego County. The budget also includes over $100 million for new LiveWell centers, parks, trails, a fire station, and other capital improvements, as well as ongoing renovations at the County Administration Center. Supervisors are expected to discuss and adopt the first year of the two-year budget plan on June 25th at 2 p.m., Public comments can be submitted to county supervisors through June 19th. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
California's new $214 billion budget, passed by the state Senate on Thursday, moves the Golden State closer to universal health coverage. The plan, which is expected to be signed by Governor Gavin Newsom, puts almost $1.5 billion over 3 years towards subsidies to lower the premiums for people who buy health insurance through the Covered California Exchange. Anthony Wright with the nonprofit Health Access says the aid is tailored to low- and middle-income people who make between $17,000 and $72,000 a year.
About 1 million Californians might get some help to better defray the cost of health care. Of those, about 300,000 get enough help that they may be newly covered from previously being uninsured.
State lawmakers propose to pay for the expansion with a state-level mandate that everyone carry health insurance or pay a fine. The budget also sets aside $100 million to allow low-income undocumented immigrants ages 19 to 25 to sign up for Medi-Cal. Critics of the budget say the extra spending is unwise and complain that it was made possible by a new gas tax of 5 cents a gallon, a policy they opposed. Wright notes the budget also restores several important benefits to Medi-Cal, things that were cut during the recession 10 years ago.
It's a shame that it's taken 10 years of an economic recovery to finally get these key benefits restored, whether they be podiatry, audiology, speech therapy, optical, and other key medical services.
The budget also ends the so-called senior penalty in Medi-Cal by changing the income limits to make about 27,000 additional lower-income seniors and people with disabilities eligible for the program. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
How did Pine Valley Community Planning Group member Warren Larkin wind up with 10 broken ribs, a collapsed lung, and a broken clavicle? A passerby found him in the middle of Old Highway 80 near his home in Huate on Saturday afternoon, June 8th. But Larkin can't remember what happened before that, his wife, Ann Larkin, told 10 News. He was airlifted to Sharp Memorial Hospital, where medical professionals told family that his injuries were far too traumatic to have occurred from merely falling off a bike. The family suspects that a motorist struck Warren's bicycle, then fled the scene. They are asking for any witnesses to come forward in hopes of finding whoever is responsible for Warren Larkin's injuries. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
The city of El Cajon is looking for a new planning commissioner to fill the vacancy left by the appointment of Commissioner Phil Ortiz to the city council. The planning commission has long been a stepping stone to higher office, with many past commissioners going on to win election or appointment to council or mayoral seats. Applications are being accepted now through June 27th at 4:30 p.m. You can get an application and requirements for the position at the city clerk's office and on the El Cajon Planning Commission's website. All applicants will be interviewed the evening of July 9th in council chambers. The applicant appointed by the city council will serve out the remainder of the term until January 2023. Reporting from El Cajon on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
To prevent a repeat of the devastating 2003 and 2007 firestorms, San Diego supervisors have allocated funds for a coordinated fire prevention effort in anticipation of a potentially severe fire season. Supervisors Diane Jacob and Jim Desmond joined with CAL FIRE and County Fire Authority officials in a press conference. Jacob, who chairs the Board of Supervisors, announced,
"Wildfire season is starting to bear down on us already, and this year could be one of the toughest years that we've seen ever. With the rain that we've received recently, which is a good thing, but from a fire standpoint, what has happened is our backcountry brush is thicker than usual, thicker than ever. And that means there's a lot more fuel to feed a fire when it hits. And it will. Since a series of deadly firestorms in 2003 and 2007, the county has worked side by side with CAL FIRE and has spent more than $500 million on firefighting improvements, including new stations, aircraft, the establishment of a bigger and better trained firefighting force. That's a huge investment, but it's not enough, and we need to do more. We need to step up the game, and that's what we're doing here today. Devastating fires last year across California and the tragic destruction of places like Paradise remind us the disaster could strike here again anytime. So today, we're announcing several county initiatives to take fire preparedness and protection to the next level.
Nearly 60,000 homes in the county's unincorporated areas are located in places considered to be at high risk of wildfire. The initiatives announced by the county this week include creating a network of fire breaks around the communities of Crest, Guate, Palomar Mountain, and other vulnerable backcountry towns. The county is also doubling the number of home safety inspections from 10,000 to 20,000, as well as launching a coordinated effort with federal, state, and local agencies to craft the regional approach to vegetation management, including controlled burns. The state of California recently awarded over $369,000 in grants to fund these fire breaks around Crest and Guate, which CAL FIRE identified as communities at high risk. The mountain community of Julian, which is involved in a contested situation with County Fire Authority and CAL FIRE over the disbanding of the Julian-Cuyamaca Fire Protection District, is also included in the Coordinated Fire Prevention Plan, according to Jacob's staff. Now the county will also expand a public education campaign aimed at encouraging homeowners to install ember-resistant vents and other fire-resistant materials. And the county hopes to start up a grant program to help residents pay for these improvements. The smallest spark can cause devastating results. CAL FIRE announced Thursday that the Ranch Fire last July began when a Potter Valley property owner up north was hammering a metal stake into the ground. A spark from metal-on-metal contact ignited vegetation nearby. Combined with strong winds and dry conditions, that fire quickly became too large to tame. The Ranch Fire, one of two fires making up the Mendocino Complex fires, torched over 410,000 acres, becoming the largest blaze in California history. A firefighter was killed, three people were injured, and 280 buildings were burned as a result of the flames. Supervisor Desmond urged the public to call 211 with questions and keep 911 open for true emergencies. He also asked everyone to stay out of the way of firefighters and sheriff's deputies during an emergency, and he notes, everyone should have a plan, since it isn't a matter of whether another major wildfire will occur, but when. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Valerie Watts
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
From Father's Day to the 4th of July, we've got lots of festive events coming up across East County. In late June, you can enjoy night fishing at Santee Lakes, the Bayou Brothers concert at Santee Lakes, Father's Day at artist James Hubbell's Julian Mountain Retreat, a Father's Day pit barbecue at the Santa Isabel Mission, and the Animar Arts Festival in Ramona.
Plus, enjoy 4th of July parades in Julian and Alpine, the Lake Murray Fireworks and Music Festival, as well as Independence Day celebrations in Santee, El Cajon, and Poway. We'll also have some all-summer-long events, including outdoor concerts, movies in the park, classic car shows, and dive-in movies at the Croc Center's swimming pool.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
The Bayou Brothers will present a rollicking concert complete with Cajun, Zydeco, and blues music at Santee Lakes on Saturday, June 15th at 7 p.m. Guests can enjoy the sounds of New Orleans and the Louisiana bayous. You can find directions to Santee Lakes at santeelakes.com.
Renowned San Diego artist James Hubbell is opening his hand-built artistic mountain retreat home to the public for an annual Father's Day tour on Sunday, June 16th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Julian. For more than 50 years, the Hubbells have been building their art-inspired home, and guests are invited to tour the iconic property's eight main structures, including the art studios, the famous Boys House, and chapel, plus the first-ever chance to explore the near-completed Ilan Lael Center, complete with gallery, amphitheater, and more. James Hubbell and his family will also share their inspirational stories about the property, which has been largely rebuilt after the Cedar Fire. The annual tour raises funds to perpetuate Hubbell's artistic mission through the Ilan Lael Foundation. For tickets, you can visit ilanlaelfoundation.org/open-house.
You're invited to bring Dad to a Father's Day pit barbecue on June 16th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the historic 200-year-old Santa Isabel Indian Mission. Contests will be held for best cowboy hats, boots, and mustaches. There will also be entertainment, vendors, a raffle, barbecue, beer, wine, and sodas. Tickets are available at the door.
You're invited to bring a lantern and drop a line for a summer night of fishing under the stars at Santee Lakes on June 27th from 5 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. Find directions at santeelakes.com.
You can explore what it means to be creative at the Animar Arts Festival on June 29th from noon to 8 p.m. in Ramona. Animar is organized by two nonprofits, the To Create Gallery and the Art Center of Ramona. Located at the scenic Beegent Ranch in the Ramona grasslands, the event features art collaborators who will offer a variety of hands-on activities, including an art apothecary store, body painting, stargazing, rock painting, a karate robot, permaculture, fused glass, a banjo sing-along, yoga, meditation, and more. Tickets are available at anomarfestival.com, and that's spelled A-N-O-M-A-R-Festival.com.
Julian's annual 4th of July parade celebrates the town's gold rush history, the dedication of veterans and active duty military members, and local residents who cherish the small-town lifestyle in the mountains of San Diego's East County. The parade rolls out at 10 a.m. down the town's main street, with activities continuing until 5 p.m. Parade entries include the Gold Drum and Bugle Corps, mariachis, bagpipes, vintage tractors and antique cars, belly dancers, Mr. and Mrs. Apple Days, Supervisor Diane Jacob, and more.
The City of El Cajon invites you to celebrate Independence Day with numerous games, live musical entertainment, and fireworks. On Thursday, July 4th, the El Cajon Recreation Department will host the annual picnic and celebration from 1 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. at Kennedy Park on East Madison Avenue in El Cajon.
The Lake Murray Fireworks and Music Fest will also be held July 4th from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. This event features food, fun, bands, and fireworks. Fireworks will be launched from a barge on the lake for viewing throughout the community. The Music Fest will be held on the San Carlos side of the lake, but the La Mesa side will also be open throughout the day and evening for fireworks viewing. For more information, you can visit lakemurrayfireworks.org.
Santee Salutes is the City of Santee's July 4th celebration held at Town Center Community Park East from 2:30 to 10:30 p.m. The festivities include live music by the 90s All-Stars, a kids' fun zone, a food area, a patriotic ceremony at 6 p.m., and then a spectacular fireworks display at 9 p.m. There's a complimentary shuttle service running from 3:30 to 11 p.m. from the Costco parking lot on Cuyamaca. Barbecues, glass, and hard liquor are prohibited at this event. And for more information, including ways that you can reserve parking and a canopy, you can visit the City of Santee's website and just click on their events calendar.
Alpine will roll out an old-fashioned 4th of July parade and a carnival from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The parade includes entries ranging from antique cars to costumed children along Alpine Boulevard, ending at the Alpine Community Center Park, home of the Alpine Veterans Wall of Honor. There you can enjoy live music, a deep pit barbecue, and a carnival with plenty of activities for children and families.
Old Poway Park will host an old-fashioned 4th of July celebration, 20th century style, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on July 4th. The historic park will have patriotic entertainment, Western reenactors, model train displays, crafts, old-fashioned games, and, for a nominal fee, tasty treats, plus rides on a historic railway. Shuttles are available from Poway City Hall's parking lot, and after the daytime activities at the park, you can drive over to Poway High School to watch fireworks at 9 p.m.
Now for some all-summer-long events.
Grab your popcorn. It's time for summertime movies at the outdoor roller skating rink at Viejas Outlets Shopping Mall in Alpine. Shows start at 7:30 p.m. each Friday night in June through early July, ending with a July 4th showing of Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and How to Train Your Dragon. For the full schedule of movies, you can visit viejas.com.
The Salvation Army Joan Crock Community Center on University Avenue, just one block west of La Mesa, invites you to a series of dive-in movies that you can watch in the swimming pool. All shows start at 7 p.m. On June 19th, the film Ralph Breaks the Internet will be showing. Then, on July 17th, you can watch Hotel Transylvania 3 Summer Vacation, followed by How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, on August 7th.
El Cajon's popular movies in the park return by popular demand this summer. You can enjoy 9 summer movies from June through August at parks across the city. Guests can enjoy additional fun activities before the start of each movie at nightfall. For a full list of shows all summer long, visit elcajonrec.org.
Lemon Grove's Summer Concert Series opens June 27th and continues through August 27th, each Thursday evening from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Berry Street Park. The series kicks off June 27th with mariachi music followed by a season that will also include salsa, Cajun Zydeco, rock and roll, Motown, country music, and more. Check the City of Lemon Grove's website calendar for a full schedule.
El Cajon's popular Dinner and a Concert series is held every Friday night at Prescott Promenade in downtown El Cajon from 6 to 8 p.m. Shows will continue all summer long. You can bring a picnic dinner or dine early at one of the many restaurants nearby before attending the concert. For a full list of shows, you can visit downtownelcajon.com.
Santee opens its summer concert series on June 13th with Elvis impersonator James Crook and the Big Boss Men. The concert series will be held from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Town Center Community Park East on Thursday nights all summer long through August 22nd. The City of Santee has the full lineup of artists on its website.
The City of La Mesa's Sundays at 6 concert series will be held at Harry Griffin Park in the Outdoor Amphitheater each Sunday at 6 p.m. The series opens June 16th with the band Trails and Rails and continues through July 28th. You can find more information, including all of the artists coming up, on the city's website.
The La Mesa Village Association rolls out its La Mesa Classic Car Show each Thursday from 5 to 8 p.m. from June through August, though there will be no show over the 4th of July weekend. The event will feature DJs and live bands located at 3rd and La Mesa Boulevard and an award giveaway at each event honoring the night's best classic cars. Find full details at LaMesaVillageAssociation.org.
El Cajon's Classic Cruise Nights includes classic cars each Wednesday from 5 to 8 p.m. along Main Street in the heart of downtown El Cajon. For a full schedule of their events, you can visit downtownelcajon.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events section at our website, eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show here on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back soon with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around East County!
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert. The FDA is warning consumers about hepatitis A virus contamination in frozen packages of blackberries and triple berry medley products. The private selection products made by Kroger were sold in Kroger, Ralph's, Food for Less, Fred Meyer, Dillon's, and other grocery chains across the United States. The recalled products have a long shelf life with Best Buy dates through June and July of 2020. Now, if you've eaten any of those frozen berries since May 24th, and if you haven't had the hepatitis A vaccine, the FDA recommends that you talk with your doctor about getting vaccinated, even if you haven't become ill. If you've already been vaccinated or previously had hepatitis A, you do not need the vaccine. Hepatitis A can result in a liver infection that may not be apparent. However, when symptoms occur, they can range in severity from a mild illness lasting a few weeks to a severe illness lasting months. The disease is spread when someone ingests the virus, usually through person-to-person contact or from eating contaminated food or drinks. Hepatitis A can have a long incubation period and have serious health consequences for some people, especially those who are immune-compromised. People infected with hepatitis A may not have symptoms until 15 to 50 days after exposure, which can make it hard to determine the exact exposure that led to illness. Symptoms may include fever, headache, fatigue, loss of appetite, nausea, vomiting, abdominal issues, yellowing of the skin or eyes known as jaundice, dark urine, and pale stools. Young children may not show these symptoms. Now, at this time, the FDA and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are not aware of any cases of hepatitis actually linked to consuming the Kroger Private Selection brand frozen blackberries. The FDA is continuing to investigate to find out if there may be other products that are tainted. Meanwhile, the FDA encourages consumers with questions about food safety to call 1-888-SAFE-FOOD.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
The San Diego and Arizona Railway, known as the Impossible Railway for the difficulty in building it in San Diego's East County, will be celebrating its centennial on November 16th. 100 years ago, John Spreckles drove in the Golden Spike, completing the railway, so we thought today would be a good time to re-air an interview that we did a few years ago with Dick Pennock, brakeman, on the railway at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum in Campbell.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Today, we are resuming our conversation with Richard Pennock, the former president and CEO, founding member, and now the media coordinator of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association. Dick Pennock, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, good morning, Helen. I'm glad to be here again with you. It's certainly my pleasure.
Last time, we learned about the size and operations of the Railway Museum. Our listeners can actually Google Pacific Southwest Railway, some variation of those words, and find you. But what's the main phone number?
The main phone number is area code 619-465-PSRM. That's 7776 on the dial.
I'm going to repeat that. It's 619-465-7776. Gosh, that's patriotic.
It is.
Sounds like the American Revolution. And it sounds like it was all the way out in Campo. You really have written the book on how to restore old trains and make them accessible to the public. Now, perhaps your most famous operation is that living history component, those weekend train rides at Campo. You are there as a conductor and locomotive engineer in full regalia, I might add. How much is a ticket, and do you still travel from Campo to Tecate?
We have weekend-only trains. We recommend that people check our website, psrm.org, to make sure of the schedule before they make the drive out there. It is a long way from San Diego, but certainly we feel it's worth the ride. We do not currently go to Tecate, and the reason is there is a railroad tunnel just over the international border on the Mexican side that burned and collapsed Christmas Day 2009. And since that time, the tunnel has not been repaired, and our monthly trips to Tecate had to be temporarily curtailed. So currently, we confine all of our operations and our special activities to the U.S. side of the border, between the border and Campo.
Why is the Campo train ride sometimes called the Polar Express?
Well, like all nonprofits, we do need to protect our bottom line, and we have many public activities, special activities during the year. The biggest one being our Santa train in the Christmas season. The first train runs the day after Thanksgiving, and we run 12 to 15 of those on consecutive weekends through the Christmas season. It is extremely popular, sold out every year, and as a matter of fact, Helen, members can buy their tickets for it right now.
Wonderful. Parents out there, get ready. Richard, at the dawn of the railroad, nobody had a union. There were no OSHA rules, occupational safety and health. So what were some of the dangers to, say, a brakeman on the railroad or another worker?
Interesting you ask about the brakeman, because on the railroad, particularly in the early days, that was one of the most dangerous occupations in train service. Now, even then, as now, you could get a job on the railroad in the office and never have to worry about ice and snow and sleet and storm. But the brakeman's job, before the days of air brakes, required that the brakeman, and they were all men in those days, had to ride the tops of the freight cars on a freight train in all weather, and they lost many of them in service, so there was generally always a job opening for brakemen, because the turnover was pretty high. It was a very hazardous occupation. Now, the passenger brakeman had it a little easier. He rode inside the passenger coaches normally with a conductor, so that wasn't quite so bad. But the freight brakeman on the freight trains, pretty horrible job.
Now, when people were riding the rails, which is the subject of poetry and song and folk music and all of the lore of the 1930s, really, what was that like for somebody to ride the rails? Where are you?
You mean like a hobo?
Yes.
Well,
In a word.
There were two different types of illegal rail riders, hobos and bums. Bums in those days had the same connotation it has today. Hobos sometimes were of a different cut. Sometimes they were riding the train illegally, but sort of looked the other way officially. because they were searching for work. They were moving from one workplace, one seasonal workplace possibly, to another, and many of the railroads often cut them a little slack and would not necessarily kick them off. They were all lumped under the term hobo, but there were differences. The bums often spent their evenings in jail when they were caught, whereas the hobos were, if you can say, maybe a somewhat higher echelon of itinerant society, shall we say.
Dick, the classic movie image is of a group of hobos. These are lonely guys in felt hats who go and offer to chop wood for a sandwich. They're all together in an empty freight car. They jump off at different points. Are we saying the wino, some poor tragic guy, is literally under that freight car? If we're riding the rails, we're so close to the rails, we're almost on them. Is that what that phrase means? It's a scary thing.
Well, not necessarily, but certainly there have been a lot of fatalities by bums, winos, others that aren't supposed to be on the property, going to sleep in a drunken stupor on a railroad track, which can be a very fatal exercise. And it happens often on the Mexican side of the border, particularly at night. It even happens on the U.S. side. It's an unfortunate part of railroad operation. There are people that don't watch the crossing signs when they're crossing railroad tracks in their car or on foot. And in spite of all the warning signs and all of the measures the railroads try to take to promote safety, there
we
are still
tragedies even now.
Still tragedies.
Exactly. Richard, you have been intimately involved with railroads for all of your life, long ago and far away, as a carefree, wind-in-your-hair young man. Didn't you ride the rails? Have you had personal experience?
I did, and I do. Even in my senior years, I continue to have experiences that I cherish very highly. I will tell you that I have never had professional railroad experience. I get asked that question a lot. But I did try to get a job with the railroad in Oakland, California, back in the mid-1950s, right after I got out of high school, because I wanted to become a fireman on a steam locomotive. And unfortunately, the railroad was getting rid of its steam locomotives at the time, and they wrote me back a Dear John letter saying, well, we're sorry, but we've laid off most of our firemen because we don't have a need for them anymore. And I always look back on those days and wonder if should I have continued with trying to get a railroad career.
Were you hand-firing a coal-burning?
No, that was on an oil-burning locomotive. It would have been had I got the job. But I had that opportunity many years later when we founded the museum. But you asked about some other adventures that I have had over the years, and those have been many, particularly with regard to trains. And I had one, and I have to tell you up front, Helen, that this was strictly illegal. Do not encourage anybody to do this. It is strictly forbidden and against the law. But I was a young, headstrong, adventurous kid in those days, and I and others decided to hop a freight train on the railroad that we currently operate on, and we were going to take this ride through Carrizo Gorge and just have a ball. So we encamped ourselves on a flat car in a freight train, and we were coming back from El Centro in late afternoon, and there are 17 tunnels just in the 11 miles of the Carrizo Gorge section, and the first tunnel is protected by an overhead structure called a telltale. Basically, it's just a wooden framework with ropes with knots on the end of them hanging down about 3 feet below the top of this gantry. And it's designed to warn a trainman on top of a car that there's a tunnel or limited head clearance coming up. So should they be facing the wrong way, it warns them that you better duck because there's something coming up that might take the upper part of your torso off. So I was facing the wrong way when we were coming up to the first tunnel and enjoying the view and the fresh air in my hair, and all of a sudden this telltale hit me in the back, and I immediately flattened on top of the car, and had I not done so, the tunnel was coming up in about an eighth of a mile, and I would have been a dead person. So it was
Richard,
very hazardous.
Thank you for sharing that. And dear listeners, this does fall under the heading of don't try this at home, unless you are the body double for Sean Connery. I think we've all seen somebody or Steve McQueen fall to the roof and suddenly there's a tunnel and the audience is aghast. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Helen.
Dick Penick, this has been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank you for stopping by and sharing the lore, some of the lore. There's obviously much more from the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. We didn't even get into the archives, and I know you have a big, big archive of precious material. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into the Sounds of History. I'm Helen O'Field.
The 100 deadliest days of summer begin at the end of May and run to the beginning of September. No, not from heat or wildfires, although those risks increase too. Summer is when teenagers hit the streets with lots of time on their hands. Per mile driven, drivers ages 16 to 19 are nearly three times more likely than older drivers to be involved in a fatal crash. During the summer months, teenage deaths in vehicle accidents have increased by 26% compared with the other months of the year. That message hit home on July 2nd in Hamul, when a head-on collision killed 19-year-old Martin Lopez Soto and his passenger, 18-year-old Hope Najera. The pickup truck Martin was driving crossed the center line at 11:45 at night, also injuring four teenagers in another vehicle. Hope and Martin were engaged to be married, but instead of celebrating a wedding, their families and friends will now gather at funerals to grieve for the young couple. Motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death for teens. On average, 260 teens are killed in car crashes each month during the summer. 60% of teen crashes are caused by distracted driving, and having other teens in the car increases crash risk. 60% of teen crashes are caused by distracted driving, and having other teens in the car increases crash risk. Reckless actions such as speeding, tailgating, and not wearing seatbelts are also more common among teens than older drivers. Here are some tips to talk about with your teens. If you're distracted by a conversation, slow down, pull over, or ask your friends to quiet down. Turn off your cell phone while driving. Never get in a vehicle with a dangerous driver, such as one who has been drinking or is constantly on their phone. Call a taxi or rideshare service. Find a sober friend to ride with, or call your parents. Driving after using drugs or alcohol, even just one drink, is a crime for teenagers, and it can ruin your ability to get a good college or find a job. It's also expensive, with large fines, increased insurance, and attorney fees. Summer is a time to relax, get outside, and have fun with family and friends. But it's also important to put safety first, so you'll have a lifetime of summers to remember. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County into Scanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jewell, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.